Welcome to African American Conservative, your source for political news and commentary from a cultural and right-of-center perspective. African American Conservative, the soul of the conservative movement.
Gerard Robinson is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he works on education policy issues, including choice in public and private schools, implementation of K-12 standards, innovation in for-profit educational institutions, and the role of community colleges and historically black colleges and universities in adult advancement. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
One issue among voters, particularly black voters who are also parents, that may not be receiving adequate attention on the campaign trail is education. Some in our audience may not be aware that you are a great person to pepper with some of our concerns, since you are not only a scholar at the prestigious American Enterprise Institute, but a board chair at the Black Alliance for Educational Options, or the BAEO as well. What is the BAEO, and what are their goals in regard to the education of black children?
Great question, and again, thank you for inviting me to have a conversation with you and your audience. As we know, education remains a vitally important topic for our community, not only for the economic but also the social well-being of our families and children, and what role will play in advancing us for the next 25 years. So BAEO was created 17 years ago by a group of black educators, faith-based leaders, advocates, business persons, and others who reach one conclusion. No matter what city we live in, we continually find black students and families to either A, have the worst options or the worst schools available to them, B, are not completing school at the rate we think is appropriate, C, if they have a great school, we don't find them going to college or to the workforce as well as we would like, and third, there seem to be a gap between those who are speaking for low-income and working-class black families and those who were speaking for others. So the organization was created, and for the last 17 years, we've promoted the idea that low-income and working-class black families need access to options, what we call a three-sector initiative: public schools, charter schools, private schools, and then it also includes the big picture: homeschool, virtual, and others.
Mm-hmm. In their report, The State of Education in Black America 2015, BAEO highlights a number of disturbing statistics, such as a remarkable 85% of black eighth graders who are at basic or below basic levels in both math and reading, and states that, quote, "We can all agree that the results of black and low-income education in the public school system is less than desirable," end quote. Why are public schools failing black children so miserably?
Well, there are some public schools who are adequately educating our kids. There are a lot of public schools who are sending our kids to the best public and private schools in the nation. If you look at some Black Rhodes Scholars, winners of National Merit and Achievement Scholars, as well as those who go on to earn Fulbright, a lot of them have come from public schools. So in no way do we think that all public schools are failing our children. At the same time, we see a disproportionate number of black children, youth, and teens who are attending schools, a lot of them dictated by where they live and the zip code, that simply are not providing them with the kind of education they need. While we have nationally, 82% of students graduating from high school, and something that we should cheer, much higher than it was in 1954 when Brown v. Board of Education was decided. But you fast forward, 61 years, and we've seen some growth, but just not the kind of growth that we would have expected given the billions of dollars we've invested into education, the hundreds, literally the thousands of hours we've put into professional development, parental outreach, and frankly, the number of bills at the state and federal level that we've implemented to turn it around. Moving in the right direction, but frankly, we just haven't gotten there yet.
Many would argue that the role of government is to use public funds to maintain and improve the public schools upon which the majority of students depend, and not only to provide easier access to non-public options. They point out that such things like charter schools hurt public schools financially by taking away the best students. Is there any truth to that argument?
Well, if you take a look at the CRADL report, which was published in 2015, which was a national study that looked at over 20 cities where we have charter schools in place. We found three things. Number one, the charter school students black students in charter schools on average tend to outperform their peers in public schools. Number two, a lot of the best and brightest students often stay in the school that works for them. Charter schools are actually getting students which are sometimes 1, 2, possibly 3 years behind. Number three, the idea that charter schools are taking money away from public education is simply untrue. At the national level, we find out that charter schools on average receive 75 cents on every dollar. They're not fully funded like traditional public schools, or they're not fully funded the way we find other alternative schools within the public education sector, magnet schools being one. Are there some great, bright black kids who are actually leaving public schools to go to charter schools? Absolutely. But we can say the same thing for magnet schools. We can say the same thing for open enrollment. The idea that we have options for children in the public school system has existed for decades. We're simply saying that the charter school model, which in the last 25 years, one of the, I would say, strongest social movements in the country in terms of school choice, are giving parents, community groups, faith-based institutions, for-profit, non-profit organizations, and teachers an opportunity to create a school, use their tax dollars they invested into the school system to create an innovative way of delivering education. And I think that's a smart way of using government money.
That's absolutely right. One issue you touch upon in your essay, Looking Backward, Moving Forward on Black Education, is the academic achievement gap between black and white students. How wide is this gap, and what are its implications throughout the life of the black student?
So it's shrinking, not as fast as we would like, and in some instances it's actually staying remaining stagnant. So you have a professor at Stanford University, Dr. Eric Hanushak, a world-class economist. In the latest edition of Education Next, it's dedicated to the Coleman Report. And the Coleman Report was really the first major report mid-60s to say, listen, we've had a huge gap in America driven by race, driven by poverty, also aspects of family. We have to close the gap. Well, he did a fast forward, to 2013 through 15, and found out that, the gap is closing amongst blacks and whites in reading and math, but not to the level we would like. Now, while I expect we're going to see some continual change, we've also got to accept the fact that we cannot, nor must we expect, schools alone to do all the work. There is a role for families. I'm a big proponent of parental rights, but I also think we need to push parental responsibility. I'm also a big proponent of civil society, and that's where other groups besides teachers and schools, we wrap our arms around schools and teachers to see what role can professional adults and others play in the process. I mentioned the Coleman Report, but we also have to look at the Moynihan Report, which was published in 1964. At that point, we found that nearly one in every four African-American child was born into a home where there was a single mom. You fast forward to today, that number is over 70%. And the white number has grown as well. I've got a colleague named Bob Dorr at AEI who's a big proponent of the two-parent family. I tell people I work with the families I have. We know there's research to show that two parents have had an impact, could have a more positive impact, let's say. But we've got lots of examples of children growing up in single-parent black homes who are doing exceptionally well. And so while there's a family component, we can't change that overnight. But what we can do is use smart public policy and civil society approaches to continue to close the black-white gap. But there's also a black-Asian gap, a black-Hispanic gap, and unfortunately, in some instances, our Native American students are doing worse than black kids.
You mentioned mentoring and involving other groups in addressing this issue. We're starting to see gentlemen's clubs pop up, and we're starting to see groups like 100 Black Men step up and get involved, and our historically black colleges and universities. How can we get more involvement from the black community in terms of mentorship?
Part of the reason I decided when I was an undergraduate student at Howard University to bypass a career in corporate America and I dedicated my life to education was because of something in D.C. called Project Success. And it started in the late 80s. It included 100 black men. It included women who were either Deltas, AKAs, those who were involved in the links. It was just a group of professionals who said, listen, we're going to go to one of the most, quote-unquote, disadvantaged schools in D.C. public schools. I think it was Stanton Elementary School. And they said, we're going to make a promise to these kids. If you stay in school and you're in the first grade, by the year 2000, you're going to be the first class to graduate. We never set up criteria. Well, fast forward, by the year 2000, money was set up to support those kids in a post-secondary effort. For me, it was great to see professionals whose children did not attend the school, who could not have, you know, could have used their time for something else. They committed to coming on Saturdays, sometimes in the summer, to tutor children. And as a student at Howard, I recruited other students to come and tutor as well. Initially, it was just for black boys. They then added black girls as well. And so for me, that was one push. There was also another program in D.C. called HITS. It was an acronym for High Intensity Training Seminar. And it was supported by the D.C. Superior Court. I don't remember the judge's name, but there was a liaison who recruited me. And the judge said, listen, we've got African-American boys in this city, well, I should say young men, between the ages of 14 and 18. They have one foot on a banana peel and one on jail. And some of them simply need great mentorship. So for 2 years, I served as a mentor there. Again, a number of black men in the city decided we're going to work with these boys and make a difference. And so I've seen firsthand how mentorship is vitally important to changing the life trajectory of students who simply needed someone to give them a hug, a word of encouragement. You fast forward to 2016, you've got a lot of black students in black colleges. You happen to mention HBCUs, Morehouse and Spelman. They actually have scholars who must give X number of hours a month to community service. A number of them were working at a charter school called Kip Strive Academy, where I had a chance to serve as a board member. That school in 2016 is the Georgia Charter School of the Year. Well, that didn't happen solely because we had a great principal and teachers. We definitely have that. And parental involvement, we have that. There was also students who were volunteering their time. So we, as the black middle class, owe this to our kids. And there are a lot of groups that are doing it, male, female, and otherwise, and would love to see that continue.
Wonderful. Researchers have found that African-American children are four times more likely to attend a high-poverty school than a low-poverty school, while white students are five times more likely to attend a low-poverty school than a high-poverty school. In other words, blacks are almost as likely to attend a financially poor school as whites are to attend a financially well-off school. How significant is this economic discrepancy in analyzing the academic achievement gap between black and white students?
So when we say financially poor school, I would like to disaggregate the terms. Number one, most of our cities, D.C., New York City, Atlanta, Los Angeles, Chicago, Detroit, Seattle, Houston, New Orleans, a lot of urban schools with a large number of black students, they do not attend a school system that's broke. A number of those school systems have multi-million dollar budgets, some billion dollar budgets, and those budgets have continued to rise while student population has continued to decline. What does that mean? Technically, you have more money for fewer students, so that's a step in the right direction. Number two, it is true that a lot of our students who are assigned to the neighborhood school attend schools with kids who live in their neighborhood, and a number of people from lower-income neighborhoods tend to attend schools with children like themselves, and so it's no shock that a lot of these kids are from, you know, we call a poor or lower-income homes. One of the things the charter school movement decided to do was to say, listen, we're not going to let poverty serve as a proxy for destiny, that you may start off this way, but you don't have to change. But guess what? You had urban schools that were non-charter schools in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s doing the same thing. I grew up in Los Angeles. We had great teachers in Los Angeles, Compton and Watts, where they had poor kids who turned those kids into college-educated adults who also sent them to the military and elsewhere. So I take something that Ron Edmonds, a former, he's passed now, but a former great African-American researcher, he said, we know everything we need to know about educating poor kids, that this really isn't an education issue, it's a political will issue. And until
That's
we get
right.
the political will to make this happen, we will pretend that we cannot educate kids in poverty, which, A, we know we've done, and there's also a role that the black church has played for over a century in educating the same population.
That's right. I mean, look at the very successful DC voucher program, the economic opportunity program, the very successful program that was pulled. And we know that those children were overachieving and did quite well. And there was quite a bit of money that was put into that program, and it was pulled.
And in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that. For your listeners, there's a book called The School Choice Journey by authors Tom Stewart and Patrick Wolf. Patrick Wolf is a professor at the University of Arkansas, possibly known as the main principal investigator for the Opportunity Scholarship Program. Tom Stewart is from D.C. He's the first UDC graduate to earn a Ph.D. at Harvard. He's now the president of Patton University in California. They gathered 5 years of data from interviewing parents who were in the program, and those parents are very clear that this program changed, A, kids' expectations of themselves. Number
yes.
two, it changed what the school system expected of parents and kids, and we just saw a tremendous amount. But guess what? Politics played a role, and unfortunately, the Obama administration found it important not to support it. Now, when Arne Duncan was secretary, he and I agreed on several items. One where we just found great disagreement was on the Opportunity Scholarship. I think it's the right thing to do for kids. He had a different opinion, and we agreed to disagree. But with the right support, we'll see that program rise again.
That's right. You wrote, quote, "Tinkering at the educational margins, throwing more money at the problem, and expecting that things will change is not the solution," end quote. Does this mean that public schools are not underfunded, at least those in poorer communities?
So it's mixed. I live near the Richmond public school system. Over 80% of the students qualify for free or reduced price lunch. They've got a real reform board in place. They've got a good reform-minded superintendent in place, as they had before. The governor, the mayor, and others have put a lot of money into Richmond public schools, and they're starting to see some results. So in some instances, they are, I won't say so much underfunded as much as there are discrepancies between revenue and expenditures. Because often mm-hmm. when we talk about schools, the first thing we say is, we need more money. Well, that's a revenue response. I'd like to know, what's your expenditure response? How much money is going directly to the classroom? Depending on whether you live in a right-to-work state or not, sometimes 62 cents on every dollar is linked to a teacher contract. Now, I grew up in a union home. I was a member of a union. I'm not anti-union. But I'm very clear that when we have conversations about schools and a parent will say, well, where's the money going? A lot of it is often linked to union contracts, which, of course, must take care of teachers who are delivering services. But I'd like
yes.
to know, where's the rest of the money going? And we frankly
yes.
don't ask enough of our school boards to say, how much does it cost to educate a student in algebra or biology or AP? Those are the kind of questions parents should ask, not how much money are we spending. Give me a line-by-line item. We should expect that of our school boards.
That's absolutely right. I am the homeschooling mother of three. And as such, we here at ACONS have been advocates for homeschooling for a very long time now. In fact, a former guest on our program, Dr. Brian Ray of the National Home Education Research Institute, shared his observation with us, one that is also quoted on the Bayo report, that black homeschooled scores are quite high. In fact, educationnews.org argues that, quote, "The achievement gaps long plaguing school systems around the country aren't present in the homeschooling environment. There's no difference in achievement between sexes, income levels, or race, ethnicity," end quote. If this is all so, then why does it seem as though many of our top current educational policymakers and influencers are either indifferent or hostile to homeschooling, especially within the black community?
As you know, black families homeschooled their kids long before there was the invention of public education,
mm-hmm.
long before there was the invention of private schools. Even
yes.
during the time of segregation, some parents
yes.
simply said, I'd rather educate my child at home than to put them in that kind of brutal system.
Yes.
So homeschooling has been something we've done, you know, for over a century. From a public policy standpoint, there is, unfortunately, very negative ideas about people who choose to homeschool. at one extreme, some people have said, you know, these are religious fanatics who don't believe in the American way of life, so they're segregated themselves, and why should we give them public money? On the other side of the fence, there are some who are saying, well, they're on the fringe, they're having some impact, but when reality sets in, they will actually come back to where they belong, which is the public school system. I personally know homeschoolers. I know many of them who are black. Many of the homeschoolers I know are middle class. They have access to resources to make it happen. In no way am I saying all of them are rich and therefore they should all homeschool. But what I have begun to push is that they're taxpayers. They still pay into the public school system, whether they choose to put, you know, have their kid at home or not. So as we pass home private school laws, whether they're individual tax credit scholarships or corporate tax credit scholarships, or whether they're, for example, education savings accounts, which I see as a new wave, you know, why shouldn't homeschool parents have access to their taxes? We've discriminated against that group for a number of years, and I think we need to have an honest dialogue about why homeschooling should be an honest and open part of our education ecosystem, not something that we choose to marginalize because we stereotype those people. And frankly, a lot of, you know, lawmakers aren't very familiar with homeschoolers. So I congratulate you for the work you do and all the homeschoolers who are listening because, A, we know it's not tough work. B, you could put your children in the public school system or send them to private school, but you choose a homeschool. And we've seen some tremendous outcomes from homeschool students. In fact, when I was an instructor at Piedmont Virginia Community College in Charlottesville, one of my top students was a homeschool student.
Well, thank you. And I have to tell you, that is one of the reasons that we do homeschool, partly for religious reasons, because we know what happens in the public schools with regard to religion and being able to openly pray and those sorts of things. But also, as a black family and knowing the black-white achievement gap, I am quite concerned about some of the things in school. My oldest son has been involved with robotics since he was in first grade. He's now in his senior year of high school. He's on a robotics team that's a very successful robotics team. And he is in he's dual enrolled. He's in his second year of college. Before he actually officially starts college, he's been an intern for a year and a half at an educational software company. And these are things that he would never, I think, get a chance to do were he a traditionally enrolled student. And these are opportunities I feel that homeschooling has allowed him to do. My daughter is just starting high school, but she has been reading at the college level for over a year. And my youngest son has some profound learning differences. He is adopted along with his sister. And we are able to homeschool to his strengths and his needs. And we're able to slow down and speed up where we need to. And I know that with some of the labeling in the school system, he'd be slapped in a special education system in a classroom and just languishing there. Whereas in our homeschool, he is able to do quite a few things where he is quite successful and feels successful. And we are able to work on areas where he has need. And these work very well for us as a homeschooling family. And I know that those would not be things that we would be able to do in a traditionally schooled environment. And one of the concerns I have as a voter, particularly a black voter, and one I have voiced quite frequently, is I'm concerned why conservatives in the political arena have not taken this on as one of their issues to increase minority votership. Because what conservative could not go into a minority community and say, would you not like better options for your children? I can't think of a parent, white, black, or any other color, who would not say, yes, I want better opportunities for my child. And because of these statistics that we've just shared, we know that these alternatives work for minority children.
Well, you bring up some very good points. One, my first real introduction to homeschool moms was at a Bail meeting in Milwaukee. I believe that was in 2000 or 2001. And they had a workshop on black homeschool parents. And we heard from one person who was a professor at a music conservatory in Dallas. I spoke to another person who was professor of engineering at a community college. guess what? Neither one of them, quote unquote, went to a traditional K-12 school. They were homeschooled. I then talked to the mom and dad, and they said, no, we decided many years ago that we were going to homeschool. And just think, these are two homeschool kids, well, now adults that you see. We used to partner with community groups throughout Milwaukee to make sure that our kids interacted with other children who had the same ideas. There was a mom from D.C. She's a part of Mocha Moms. And she had mentioned back in the 70s and 80s that some parents were actually arrested because they chose not to put their children in school, but instead chose to have them involved in homeschool. Now, DCPS has evolved in how it works with homeschool families. There's now an office that deals with, I think it's called Educational Options or non-public school options. So some public school systems are finding, I would say, healthier ways to involve communities in there. You mentioned robotics. A lot of STEM students or a lot of homeschool students that I met during the time I was Secretary of Education in Virginia who were homeschooled, a lot of them are pretty strong in STEM. Robotic clubs, science clubs. They were competing against public, independent, and religiously based private schools, sometimes winning it all, sometimes placing well. And so it was even part of my own education to say, yeah, you know, this is a role to play. As it relates to conservative voters, here's where the Republican Party almost had sometimes a mixed message. I don't think they market enough the role that they supported with school choice. I mean, let's be real clear. In Milwaukee, D.C., Cleveland, New Orleans, the four urban-based programs with the voucher program, that would not have passed without Republican support, be it legislature or governor. And a few instances, like Louisiana, it was a black Democrat, in this case in New Orleans, Ann Duplessis, or in Milwaukee, Representative Polly Williams, or in Washington, D.C., Mayor Anthony Williams and others, who said this is important for kids. And so one way for the Republican Party to do better outreach is to promote school choice. At the same time, they've got to come up with a pretty good response, because I hear it all the time. Yeah, the Republican Party supports school choice in K-12, but they're against affirmative action in higher ed. They're for taking money to put into charters, vouchers, and tax credits, which we support, but then they don't want to fund, you know, higher teacher salaries. So as a party, we've got to find ways of answering that question. But the first part is to go in and talk about it. And we're doing a good job, but I think we can do more.
You're absolutely right. If you're just joining us, our guest has been Gerard Robinson from AEI and BAO. Gerard, what's next for you, and how can we continue to follow your work?
So AEI, I have a homepage. I publish, you know, one op-ed a week on my webpage. So I would say, you know, every Friday, take a look to see what I've written. Number two, I host a number of events, and you can either, if you're in the D.C. area, come and watch it in person, or they're live streamed. For example, last week I had an event called the Southern Manifesto at 60, Lessons from the Past, you know, lessons for the ideas for the future, where we took a look at the fact that the Southern Manifesto, March 12, 1956, that 101 members of Congress signed basically a resolution saying the Supreme Court was absolutely wrong on saying that separate but equal was unconstitutional. And they pretty much said that we're not going to allow the southern states to adhere to this law because, A, education appears nowhere in the Constitution, and, B, education is a state and local issue, not a federal issue. Well, what that law did was to give a green nod to the southern states who, from 1956 to 1969, involved themselves in different forms of massive resistance, whether it led to the closing of Prince Edward County Public Schools from 1959 to 1964, or the creation of tax credit programs where the state gave white families money to go to segregated academies and at times closed or underfunded black schools. So fast forward to 2016, a number of those southern states today have private school choice laws as well as charter schools, and a number of the families who are benefiting from it are African American. And so we have to learn from the past what went right, what went wrong, and then today to make sure that we don't repeat mistakes of the past, but also not to let people tell us that private school vouchers or tax credits are somehow warmed over Jim Crow policies that are really undercutting public education. That's simply not true. So those are some of the events that I have on place. And if you ever want me to come to give a lecture at a local university or a nonprofit organization, feel free to send me an email and we'll see what we can do. But part of my job of being at the American Enterprise Institute, where we support opportunity, individual freedom, and the role of the free market system in changing lives, is to be a thought partner. We need time to think and reflect, and I'm fortunate to be in a position to do that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being our guest.
No, thank you for having me, and if we can partner on something, you've got my phone number and email, let me know.
Thank you. Karen Brannon is a veteran journalist who has written for newspapers, magazines, the stage, and television for almost 50 years. Her work has appeared in Life, Mother Jones, Ms., Ladies Home Journal, Good Housekeeping, and on PBS, CBS, ABC, CBC, the BBC, and CNN. Her most recent book is entitled The Family Tree, A Lynching in Georgia, A Legacy of Secrets, and My Search for the Truth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marie.
You wrote, quote, "Ever since I was a child, I wanted to be a writer. More specifically, I wanted to write a book about a small town in the South. I believed it was meant to be," end quote. Was that the book you set out to write when you sat by your grandmother's bed with a tape recorder in 1984? If so, what happened that that book became, quote, "a full-scale excavation of family history," end quote, that we find in the family tree?
Good question. Well, I had no thought when I went up there or down there to Hamilton, Georgia with my tape recorder. I had no thought of a book at that time. I wanted to preserve her story for future generations. My grandmother was in her early 90s, and we didn't think she had much longer to live. I think she lived a couple more years after that. But I wanted to ask her as many questions about her life as I possibly could. At the end of the interview, I said, "What is your most unforgettable memory?" And she said, "The hanging." Without a thought, it was as if it were sitting there on the tip of her tongue. And I said, "What hanging?" And she said, "Well, they hanged a woman and some men downtown when I was a young girl." And I was told not to go, but everybody else was going, so I went. And I've never forgotten it. And I said, I asked her a few questions, and the way she answered my questions made it sound like it was a judicial execution and that some people had been tried and found guilty. She said they were moonshiners. She didn't mention race at all, which in the South usually means they're talking about white people, because white people in the South back then, anyway, if any black people were involved, you'd be sure to know that. So I just assumed that it was something, I thought it was a little weird that they had hanged a woman out of doors, but then it was the South, and I knew that things could be kind of weird down there. So I didn't ask her much more about it, unfortunately, because I never got a chance to come back and talk to her about it specifically. But a couple of years later, I was living in Minneapolis at the time, and I had a son who was a senior in high school, and in 1986, he and his African-American girlfriend came home with nervous smiles on their faces and told me that I was going to be a grandmother. And I was not happy about that. They were much too young. They weren't a particularly compatible couple in many ways, and I was generally fairly despondent about it, but I also began to have terrible nightmares and feel fears for them that were far out of proportion to reality. I had spent most of my adult life working for racial justice and working on different kinds of projects to help people stop being so racist, white people, and I had raised a son who was not a racist, and, you know, it shouldn't have bothered me as much as it did. I did have still racist white relatives, including my mother, still living in Georgia, and I was not particularly looking forward to what their reaction might be. But as I said, it went much deeper than that. And several things happened along the way that I've detailed in the book that sent me back down to Georgia. I knew I had to look into my family history, that there was something going on there. And I remembered some stories that my father had told me when I was about 11, and he had a problem with alcohol. He was an alcoholic. And I and my sister were trying to get him to stop drinking. And he said the reason he could not stop drinking was because he was punishing himself for accidentally killing a young black woman when he was a young man. And 11-year-olds can't deal with something like that from their fathers, so I just kind of stuck that away in the back of my mind. But that was kind of a time bomb that started ticking and sort of went off in my head that, oh, my God, this really happened. So I went down to Georgia, to Harris County, which is about 60 miles south of Atlanta, on the Alabama border, and I started asking questions about my father, and he was dead at the time, so I couldn't ask him. But he had told me that my mother's sister was with him at the time. She was 12 and he was about 17. So she was still alive. So I asked her about this and she said, well, you know, what he described to you happened. He did hit this girl, but she didn't die. In fact, she outlived him. And I checked into that and saw that, you know, he had spent his life basically believing that he had killed somebody that he hadn't. Anyway, so then I asked my aunt, who had grown up, not grown up, but had lived all her adult life next door to my grandmother in Hamilton, Georgia. And I said, well, what about this hanging that your mama told me about? And she said, well, all that, she said, was a bunch of white men fighting over a colored girl. She said they did that a lot back then. Well, that was completely new information to me. I was rather naive about Southern history, especially that aspect of it. And but I figured that had something to do with what was troubling me about my own son, and I immediately saw that it was an interracial thing that probably went much deeper than I wanted to go, but I decided I had to go there anyway. And so I found in the Atlanta Constitution a few days later, I was living in D.C. at the time, I still live in D.C., short blocks from the Library of Congress, and I went looking for this. I found it was almost, Marie, like the universe kind of started dropping breadcrumbs along my path, little hints, little clues. I was at my sister's house in Atlanta the next day, and she had received a book of Southern history for her birthday from a friend, and in that book was one sentence that gave the date of the lynching of a woman and three men in Hamilton, Georgia, January 22nd, 1912, and that was really all I needed to begin what you referred to as a full-scale excavation of my family history. At the time, however, I really did not know that this was about my family. I had not a clue that this lynching was about my family. So I go home the next day. I go running down to the Library of Congress. I have to go through the microfilm machine because this was 1995, and we didn't have everything popping up on the internet now the way we do now. I did not expect much. I had no idea. I'd never done any historical research, especially not into lynchings. I just assumed that they kind of got, if they got reported at all, they got buried somewhere back on, you know, the back page. I get to January 23rd, 1912, Atlanta Constitution, and there is huge headlines on the front page about these four people who had been lynched in Hamilton, Georgia. And there was my mother's maiden name, which was Hadley, in two or three different headlines. And you could have knocked me over with a feather. I was so stunned. And I knew that I knew my mother's grandmother, my mother's grandfather was a sheriff. Her father was a sheriff. I've located actually six sheriffs of Harris County, Georgia, on both sides of my family. So, you know, there was a lot of reason for me to know that, you know, that they probably, that some bad things probably had happened, but I didn't feel that way. I really idolized. I would tell people, well, you know, a lot of Southern sheriffs were really bad guys, but mine weren't. Mine were good guys, and my own grandfather, Sheriff Douglas Hadley, was sheriff of Harris County for 26 years while I was alive, and before I was alive, he died when I was 16. So for the whole 16 years I knew him, he was the sheriff of Harris County, and I always saw him as a very kind, easygoing. He seemed to have good relationships with people of both races in the town. There never were any scandals that I knew about while I was growing up. I later found out that there were some sort of mini scandals that got swept under the rug, and that he wasn't quite as pure and perfect as I thought he was. But to be involved in a lynching, and he was the 21-year-old deputy sheriff to his father the night that happened. So I was, I was stunned, but I was able to pick out a few things from those articles that day that made me think that maybe my great-grandfather was a hero, because it said that he had stopped a week before, he had stopped the mob. He had gotten them to agree with him that he was on his way to the jail with the suspects. They were never arrested. They were always just suspects. The woman wasn't even a suspect. She was was supposed to be a witness, really the only witness they had. And he was going to go down to Columbus, which was just down the road a piece, to get a special trial. And he told the mob, who were his relatives, we're going to do this right. He had just been elected, and he didn't want to spoil the first few weeks of his time in office with something like a lynching. And so the mob agreed, and he went down and got the special trial set up for 30 days. I think it was 45 days from then. And but things happened in the next 7 days. The case fell apart, and things happened. And so what happened was what happened. At midnight on January 22nd, these four people, including the woman, and she would be, her name was Loduska Crutchfield. They called her Dusky, and she was the first woman to be lynched in Georgia. One of the men was a preacher. AME preacher. One of the men was one of his deacons, a farmer, and another man, a farmer, was related to my family, my mother, the sheriff's family, from slavery days. So these were all, this was a lot of new information for me. Completely changed my ideas about a lot of things having to do with the South and my family.
The catalyst for much of the tragedy in the family tree was, as you've said, the murder of Norman Hadley. Who was he, and why did the circumstances of his unfortunate death lead him to be, as you put it, quote, ascended into local sainthood, end quote?
Okay, well, Norman Hadley was the sort of ne'er-do-well nephew of the new sheriff. But Norman was like a son to the sheriff, because his father, the sheriff's older brother, had either died or walked away when Norman was two. And Buddy Hadley, the sheriff, had taken Norman in hand, trying many ways to save him from the gunslinging, hard-drinking, moonshine-making life of the men he was raised with, both black and white. The general tendency in those days, Marie, when an interracial murder occurred, was for the press to polish the image of the white man and worsen the image of the black suspect. So from the moment that Norman's body was discovered, the stage was being set for a lynching. Throughout the South in those days, the early part of the 20th century, there were two things that justified a lynching, even in the minds of more high-minded whites who would normally oppose them. And that was the rape by a black man of a white female and the murder of a sheriff or other lawman. So the folks were kind of hankering for a lynching anyway, I think, and Norman, being almost like the son of the new sheriff, filled the bill for the moment. Norman also had several other former sheriffs in his family tree as well. And it helped also that Norman was well-liked, at least by whites. There had been a series of murders among the men who lived around Norman. It was a big moonshine territory. They had a wild lifestyle. And so, you know, they cavorted together, black and white, partied together at night. White men were involved with black women sexually, whether the women wanted to be or not. I'm sure they didn't have much say in the matter. And there were a lot of killings. And there had been maybe six or seven, black on white, then white on black, back and forth among the people in that district since 1907. And none of those had really been dealt with particularly as racial incidents, but they were just kind of boys will be boys, self-defense sort of things, because that is, in fact, what they were. But at this point, a lot of people were really fed up with that attitude. But in the background, there was also a major anti-miscegenation campaign going on, led by a former Georgia governor. And he was joined by some very powerful black ministers as well, because basically what they were trying to end was white men going with black women. And in Harris County, there was a lot of that happening. And one of the, in some ways, it was just the Norman Hadley, the bachelors, and the black guys having parties and black women being there. But in a lot of cases, there was also what my mother described to me as a very extensive system of two-family families in the county, in which a white man would have a black family and a white family. And I'm quite sure they weren't treated equally, that they didn't have equal access to money or anything like that. But it was a situation that people knew. I mean, you know, he wasn't just kind of sneaking into some black woman's house late at night and taking advantage of her or paying her whatever was going on. These were considered families. And she said everybody knew, you know, who the white man was. The kids all looked alike. The kids knew who each other were. And there was an attempt to embarrass the South about this coming from the North. A lot of Northern journalists were coming down. W.E.B. Du Bois at the crisis in NAACP's magazine was fomenting against it. Not so much the two families. I'm not even sure he dealt with that, but he was fomenting against white men taking advantage of black women, and he was calling on black men to defend them. And this preacher, Burl Hardaway, who was one of the four men lynched, one of the four people lynched, had been preaching against Norman Hadley by name in the pulpit, because Norman Hadley apparently was a well-known chaser or predator after black women. And in this particular case, he was going after a young black teenager who had connections to all these men. This was the circumstantial evidence that they had against them. They had no real evidence, but it looked like they may have had they had a motive, and had some reason to have wounded Norman Hadley dead. So so he started looking a lot better than he actually was. When I first read articles about Norman Hadley's murder, he was described as a wealthy plantation owner, a well-established citizen of the community. When I really looked into the details of his life, I discovered that he really had never amounted to much of anything. And had actually been arrested many times for moonshine and brought into federal court in Columbus. He always got off. They all got off. Even the black guys got off because they were kin to the white guys, and so they had their sheriffs and they had their lawyers and they had their people to protect them. It was a little bit kind of like a moonshine mafia, you might say. Yeah.
You say, quote, one major and mostly unmentioned factor fueling racism and increasing segregation was the reality of black-white intimacy and the political need for whites to deny and distance themselves from it, end quote. How did miscegenation also fuel the response to Norman Hadley's death?
Well, because it was so widespread and because it was getting out into the open, and because there were a lot of people that, you know, I think that, you know, one thing is that women white women, where everybody was speaking out against it. Not, I don't know that everybody who was speaking out against it was that much against it, but, you know, wanted to seem to be against it. And black and white, nobody was really supporting it openly. So it provided a, you know, it provided a pretext, you know, for a lynching. And I mean, I think that you know, they didn't want this information to get out. I mean, it never really came out in local papers what was going on. It did come out in northern papers. It came out in the Crisis. It came out in a lot of church white church papers and a lot of black newspapers as well. But I think that there was a sense, you know, blacks had already been, this was a time where official segregation of black and white was the order of the day in the South. African Americans, Georgians, had already been disenfranchised. By 1906, there were, you know, hardly a dozen black voters left in the state of Georgia. They were beginning to segregate everything, streetcars, parks, public spaces that had not been segregated were being segregated all over the state. There had been a level of black-white intimacy, and I'm not talking about sex, I'm just talking about, you know, people living next to each other, people living close to each other, because most of them had stayed on the old farms, and, you know, the farms were split up, and some blacks owned their own land, though that was rapidly being lost as well. But there had been, ever since the 1880s, really, there had been a cutting back on freedoms that African Americans had won after the war, and you know, what little they had gotten during Reconstruction. And a lot of African Americans in Harris County had done quite well. I went through all the censuses looking at the packages of land that they owned and you know, and their net worth, and there were districts and including the district where Norman lived in Mountain Hill, that you could really hardly, unless you read the racial designation, you could not tell really from education level and wealth who was black and who was white. But that, you know, and that was getting on a lot of people's nerves too. There was a lot of jealousy and a lot of animosity about the increasing success of black farmers in the South and in Harris County. And literacy rates had gone up tremendously during Reconstruction and well into the 1890s, actually. And, you know, I don't think any of this was natural. I don't think it came naturally. I think a lot of it got drummed up. A lot of racial resentment got drummed up by politicians during the populist movement in the 1890s. But poor blacks and poor whites came closer together than they ever had and really threatened the power of the oligarchs or the ruling class. This scared people. It scared the people in charge, and so, you know, racism got used as a tool to divide black and white, and it's been there ever since, unfortunately. And, you know, it works very well from time to time.
If you're just joining us, our guest this segment has been Karen Brannon. We're discussing her latest book, The Family Tree, A Lynching in Georgia, A Legacy of Secrets, and My Search for the Truth. What's next for you, and how can we continue to follow your work?
Well, what's next for me right now is I'm about to catch a plane to Georgia to give two readings of my book in my hometown of Columbus, Georgia. So that's something I'm both looking forward to and approaching with a little bit of trepidation, because the book wasn't particularly kind to Columbus, at least in the past. And I, you know, I'm sure there are people who will probably take offense, though I have had lots of letters from old friends who are happy that I wrote the book and congratulating me for it. I'm probably going to write another book at some point that will go a little bit more deeply into just the interior process of facing up to some of these crimes of my ancestors and how this whole process has left me strangely feeling more free than I ever have in my life. And I'm not quite sure why that is, but I want to investigate it. I'm also working with a group called Coming to the Table, which was founded by the black and white descendants of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and other founders of the United States who are working on racial healing. And we do a lot of good work out in the community on the Internet, and it's a group that anybody can join who might be interested in looking more deeply into their roots.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Marie.
Thank you for joining African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Please join us at www.AfricanAmericanConservatives.com. There you'll find information about our Twitter feed, Facebook page, and our blog. All opinions expressed here are those of this show and our guests. Copyright African American Conservatives.